Good morning and welcome to WMFO. If you have been if you're just tuning in, WMFO in Medford. That's WMFO Medford, Tufts free form commercial free community based radio. And we are here every Sunday I'm sorry, I just got distracted by a technical thing. We're here. Socialist Alternative Radio is here every other Sunday, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Today's show, we're going to be talking about something you probably didn't hear too much about in the corporate media, a recent victory for labor. We're going to be talking about the UPS workers that are coming up, those ubiquitous brown trucks you see driving around with the brown uniformed workers. They're coming up with an important union decision, a vote on a contract. And we'll be talking about green capitalism. Is it possible? That sort of thing. And we've got a lot of other things to talk about on the show. But as I mentioned, just got sidetracked by an odd thing happening here. So I will try to correct this problem. You are listening to Tufts Educational Radio, another way we describe ourselves here. And before we start off with Social Alternative Radio, we'll put on some more music for you to enjoy, and we'll be right back. Thanks.
What do we got? Magnificent! Jefferson. What do we got? Luther King and Mahatma Gandhi went to the park to check on the game. But they was murdered by the other team. Went on to win 50-0. You can be true, you can be false. You'll be given the same reward. Socrates and Milhouse Dixon both went the same way through the kitchen. Plato the Greek or in Tin Tin. Who's more famous to the billion millions? Who's Flash? Vacuum cleaner sucks up Budgie.
And that was The Clash with The Magnificent Seven, where they talk about listening to Marx and Engels. Wow, still having difficulty here. Okay, hold on. Let's see. Yeah. By the way, if you just tuned in, you're listening to Socialist Alternative Radio, talking music from a working class democratic socialist perspective. And we start off the show in a kind of confused way a little bit because of a technical glitch here, which are happening a lot actually at the station recently. Hope to get things running more smoothly. As you might have figured out, we emanate from Tufts University here in Greater Boston, actually the border of Medford and Somerville. And we do have our listeners from out of town via live streaming on the internet or through the archive at WMFO.org. We even have listeners from overseas, and thank you for listening in and for writing to us on Facebook. Go to Socialist Alternative Radio on Facebook to interact or to see postings. We put a lot of posts up on Facebook, and sometimes archives of the show up on Facebook. Sometimes, what is going on with this? I don't understand what's going on with this thing here. I'm sorry, there's just this weird thing happening to this automatic thing that that goes out on the web showing what we're playing and what we're talking about, and I've got things popping up on it that I don't get. I don't understand where they're coming from. It's really strange, and I can't explain it. Like play songs that are coming up that I'm not playing, and hopefully you're not hearing. I don't see any indication on the board that you're hearing anything from any other source, and yet they're popping up on my playlist. So, wow, okay, that's new. Thank you so much, people that are doing that, whoever's responsible. So, if you're a first-time listener, what we're doing on this show is we are giving alternative, you know, news and information from a left-wing perspective, but we're also trying to organize people into the socialist movement, specifically into Socialist Alternative. And if you want more information about Socialist Alternative, go to socialistalternative.org. Go to Socialist Alternative on Facebook, Social Alternative in the U.S. Go to socialistworld.net because we're in political solidarity with the Committee for Works International. But we're just trying to turn you on to basically the ideas, general ideas and methods of Marxism, and hopefully you will take an interest, learn more yourself, get involved in different movements and different and, you know, get involved with an organized way of you know, getting out your ideas, and an organized way of their strength in numbers and all that stuff, power in a union, etc., to be more effective as an activist. I have grown up here in the United States, obviously, and, well, not obviously, but I have anyway. And I think something curious, perhaps, to the United States is the idea that that you could be a sort of an independent socialist. Yeah, well, I don't know about that. I mean, I can certainly see the arguments that people make for why they can't be that involved in politics, but everyone can be involved in some way. And to be an individual socialist seems like an oxymoron. It seems like you need to be in an organization to be an effective socialist. So, yeah, I guess you could say you're an independent socialist, but you should always maybe say I'm temporarily an independent socialist till I find an organization or a way I can help others change things. You can't change society from capitalism to socialism alone, and your additions to that fight, your contributions to that fight as an individual are extremely limited. And people are, you know, people's bodies are needed out on the street, and people's minds and brains and hands and help and empathy and support and so on are needed in organizations. And, you know, in the U.S., there's a huge, and Arun Hadi Roy writes about this in other countries, a huge NGOization of politics. You know, if you have your, you know, if you have your, if you join an NGO, you can, you know, a non-governmental organization in the sense of something funded probably by rich liberals or somebody, and find your little niche in there that you're somehow doing good. And sure, I'm sure some good comes out of those things, but really it's more about changing things through organizing more and more people and helping people learn their own, learn how to fight for themselves. You should always be sort of replacing yourself in the socialist movement, at least. And that means that, you know, you're not confining your efforts to one issue. You're not confining yourselves to the constraints and parameters set by the rich donors of the NGOs, that sort of thing. There's also people that make their lives and living in academia and create the perception that that is like the most effective political place to be, especially in the United States. That happens a lot with you know, star professors, Noam Chomsky, Howard Zinn, you name it. And I like, I took classes with Howard Zinn. I had classes with Howard Zinn. I audited a class with Noam Chomsky. I've gotten a lot of Noam Chomsky talks and so on. I'm not trashing them at all, and perhaps they would agree with what I'm about to say, is that you're very actually limited in academia in terms of what you can do. Again, subject to the funding and rigors, so-called, of academic life. And so you really might seem like you're influencing a lot of people and doing a lot with, you know, writing and teaching. And there certainly does influence people somewhat. But what more influence could you have in it, you know, if you were active? And as an academic, you could be. It's a stretch, but you could be active in union organizing, active in community organizations, active in, most importantly, some sort of socialist group. In other countries, academics do tend more to join some sort of socialist party or group. We don't have a mass socialist party here, so that's maybe problematic, but they would even tend to join groups and so on. That can bring about its own problems if they are made leaders just because of their professorshipness, you know. But anyway, there's a whole world outside of academia of organizing for socialism and organizing at a grassroots level that isn't well known here in the U.S. because the socialist left doesn't have as deep a base as the socialist and you know, radical left has in the working class and other as it does in other countries. Of course, it's a chicken or the egg thing. One of the main reasons for that is the lack of a mass workers' party in this country, a mass socialist party, communist party, labor party, whatever you want to call it, party of the sort that doesn't get any money from big business or the corporations, of the sort that puts forward an alternative history and has actually material, has money and a press and radio and TV and so on to back that up, that worldview up, and to you know, just to exist as a party running candidates that aren't bought and paid for, even if even in Europe where a lot of the social democratic parties and original sort of left-wing parties have been have mutated into kind of more parties that aren't really revolutionary anymore, aren't interested in socialism in the real sense of the word, and they they've been bought off and so on. Even there, the origin of those parties, the fact that those parties still exist and they had revolutionary origins is something you would probably learn about in school, something you might learn about from, you know, your someone at work or parents or whatever, friends. It permeates society. Left-wing ideas permeate society more. And that's because of the concrete existence historically and even maybe even contemporary, even now, of parties, political parties that aren't like the Democrats or the Republicans, bought and paid for by big corporations, by big business, and historically were even revolutionary, or even are trying to be now, in terms of socialism. And so, you know, replace capitalism with democratic socialism, that sort of thing. So the United States lacking that in any recent historical time period is a huge impediment to the formation of really of a lot of solidarity, a lot of empathy for other people, of a working class consciousness, and of political expression, you know, in electoral politics or even in movement building. A lot of movements in other countries, good, you know, grassroots movements, end up affiliating or supporting left-wing, you know, workers' parties that are completely independent from the big corporations, and that's a good thing, if the depending on what policies the parties put forward. So there's a whole avenue, a whole experience, a whole way to do politics in other countries that is lacking here, and in the vacuum, some kind of really unhealthy tendencies come up where people think that working in some NGO, or working for a charity, or working just or being a left-wing academic, that these take the place of movement building among the working class, with the working class, with working class people, of building both movements and also electoral alternatives to the, you know, the hegemony. I hate that word; it's too big. I never like that word. Through the influence that are outside the influence of the Democratic Party and Republican parties in U.S. political circumstances. And, you know, I could have this discussion with union leaders, and I've done that. I've had this discussion, and they would look at you a little at this point in history, look at you a little funny. Outside the Democratic Party, how could I even imagine a world outside of the Democratic Party? Because they're so used to doing a sort of good cop, bad cop routine with the Democrats. This Democrat's good, this one's bad. I'm going to go talk to this one, and I don't like that one, and I'm going to try to raise some money for that one, and we'll send out people at election day. This is a union leader speaking, and we'll help you get elected. You know, this is a poisonous relationship, a really abusive relationship, actually, on the part of unions and the way they are abused by the Democratic Party on a regular basis, day-to-day basis, if you really get into the labor movement. And yet the labor leaders seem to not understand this or, more importantly, see no alternative to it. And the idea that the alternative must be built and that they can play a role in this is beyond the perception of most of them, because most of them aren't socialists. They don't understand the history that labor always tends to try to build a political expression and de facto, just as a matter of course, as a matter of the way things are set up in the society by capitalism, has to try to build that political party without capitalist influence in terms of money, and primarily money, but also in terms of you won't be able to use the capitalist media, you won't be able to use the capitalist, the corporate media, you won't be able to use the capitalist institutions to organize for socialism. You got to create your own. And I don't mean that can be misconstrued. I'm not talking about the very much overstated worker co-op thing. I'm not talking about free universities, as we used to say, or, you know, little enclaves of little groups that exist here in the United States and are well-meaning oftentimes, but they want to sort of separate out and educate themselves, you know, and try to create like a socialism within capitalism. That's not at all what I'm talking about. I'm talking about creating the weapons to fight capitalism, in terms of education and activism, and building organizations like unions and workers' parties and community groups that are truly accountable to the community and not to rich donors and so on, and that sort of thing is can be a hard slog, and people want instantaneous results. You know, until they see an alternative, they say they will not stop voting lesser evil or whatever, or they won't stop begging Democrats for this or that. And that's that seems pragmatic, except that if you're putting your energy into begging Democrats and begging rich people for things, then you're not going to have the time or energy to do what could happen fairly quickly with the right resources, build a truly independent political party, meaning independent of the big corporations, and have a political party that represents working people in general, union, non-union, youth, people that are retired, they can't work anymore, or they're not being hired because of age discrimination or something. A place for the 99%, really, if you want to really think about it. Even people that seem well off under the system, but are really, if you had an honest discussion with them, have a beer or two, and then it comes out, geez, I'm so in debt, I'm living paycheck to paycheck, which is so common in the United States among people that look like they're doing well. Someone is driving an SUV down the road. Don't assume they live in the dream, you know, that they're probably paying a large car loan in addition to a large mortgage if they have a home, or a large rent, and et cetera. So I don't want to get into all the permutations, that there are many in the United States, and it's a whole big sport here, if you're listening from another country, but a whole big game here, who can out frugal the next person, who can live more cheaply than the other person and make it work, you know, make the system, you know, defeat the system through self-austerity, so to speak, you know. And then all of a sudden something happens unexpected, a medical expense in this country with no health insurance, no national health insurance, no socialized medicine, one medical bill can send you hurtling into bankruptcy, and there's lots of statistics on that happening to tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of Americans. Or you could, get hit the tipping point on debt, not pay your mortgage, then your credit report takes a horrible hit. And the fact that everyone is locked into a credit report, or most people are, is ridiculously oppressive and a symbol of how unfree we are, that we're not free as we think we are. We are slaves to debt. We are slaves to the capitalist system as wage slaves. And part of that now is credit reports. So you take, you something happens, you lend some money to a relative, you try to pay for a child's college, which is now an astronomical expense, and you end up having reaching a tipping point where you don't pay a bill on time, like especially an important one like a mortgage. You lose your house, you lose everything in terms of the credit report, making it going way down. Then you can't declare bankruptcy or something. Supposed to erase your debt, but in reality, it becomes a way to be denied more credit, and you don't have a job that you can make enough cash, so to speak, to overtake credit to save enough money to buy the things you need. That's why people are in debt so badly in America. Nobody has. Statistically, hardly anyone has salaries big enough to allow them to buy big things like a car or a house or a condo or an education now or healthcare now, and all these things that didn't used to be big things but now are. And on top of all that, we're lectured on a daily basis by the banks because they get money off of this, but also by TISC, the government, and people that buy into the propaganda they hear every day, which are a lot of people. You'll find a lot of people in the U.S. Because of the strength of the corporate media, and I don't mean this as an insult, but it's just a fact that you will, if you start to engage with your coworkers, let's say, and a lot of workplaces aren't even set up this way, but say you're at a workplace where people can talk to each other a little bit, you know, maybe on breaks and stuff, and you start talking about politics, you know, people are at first, if they're not engaged in politics in any way, any serious way, they're going to just spit back what they hear from the corporate media. You know, it's going to make them feel good to say something that sounds learned, which is really just a cliche they've heard like 50 times. And one of them would be, in the last week, let's say, one of them would be that TISC, Americans aren't saving enough for their retirements. And this percentage of Americans is without enough retirement money to retire when retirement comes, and all these scary statistics, without ever talking about it's the capitalism behind that and the destruction, the deliberate destruction of pensions in the United States as a way of surviving when your labor is no longer going to be bought by the capitalists because you're old and they're doing age discrimination, then you know, without getting into the real root causes of why people can't save enough money for retirement and can't retire in the United States now, a lot of people, more and more people, then instead of getting into those root causes, they just make it your fault. Oh, you're not saving enough money. But then you say, well, if you're honest, you say, well, wait a minute, I'm actually going into debt. How can I save money if I'm going into debt just to survive, just to get a house repair done, or just to, you know, save money in another little bank account for my kids' college, which, gee, I'm not really saving much there either, you know, or I'm saving money. I am saving money for my retirement, but it's just not going to be enough, and isn't nearly enough as what I would have gotten 30, 40 years ago, or like my parents got when the labor movement got strong enough to demand pensions, right? The union, especially the unionized part of the labor movement, got pensions, and therefore the non-union part, businesses often had to offer pensions as an incentive, imagine this, to work at that company, right? During the post-war upswing, right? And then when it recessions hit, and then the Great Recession of 2007-2008, the businesses figured in various ways, through exploiting immigrants, through doing less training, of making jobs like, as you know, making it so people could take the place of other people as quickly and as simply as possible. They had already driven down wages very, very low, so they could rely on a more malleable contingent workforce. All the you know, scheduling and the world of contingent work that people are unfortunately almost getting used to. These are things that allow businesses to hire more widely without as much specialized training. It's just the opposite of what you hear actually in the media, that, oh, gee, it's because of computers and so on, businesses require much a higher level of training in manufacturing and other things. That's true in some jobs, but in the vast majority of jobs, businesses are always trying to dumb things down to the point where they can either automate, if possible, that's a lot less frequent than you would think. Well, we can talk about that in a second, but or just get people in the door without, and not having to train them up, and not having them have expectations of things like pensions or anything other than a few hours of work, maybe not even scheduled per week. Now, here we are in the United States in a sort of temporary boom period where now the bosses are crying about a shortage of labor, and I think that's true in some areas. And that also means that some workers will start to demand certain things, and the bosses, the companies, will have to start providing them, and that could be more regular scheduling and so on in some non-union workplaces, or even union workplaces to a certain extent, but also higher wages. And we're also seeing uptick in labor struggles, although still at a much lower rate than at other times in history, but we'll get into that in a minute. But getting back to this automation question, which is another thing that's being fed to us, sort of like the pension thing, right? You know, you're told every day, oh, you're not saving enough money for your retirement. The reality is we're not making enough money to save enough money for our retirement, because capitalism has done everything it could to drive down wages. And as the unions have weakened, that has been a more and more successful strategy for capitalism, for the capitalists in general. And where wages are stagnant for decades or declining in a lot of places, and right now, there's the idea that you can get a job of some sort, although the pay will probably suck and the conditions will be bad. And it's bad. It's horrible that people are conditioned to think that way, but or accept those parameters. But that's happening right now. And in a lot of places, obviously, with a lot of people. But there's also, you know, limits to, you know, taking a second or third job. You know, all the stuff about the family life and how, in the U.S., we respect families and all that. Well, if you're working all the time, what's your family life like, right? It's crap is what it is. There isn't one. You know, you don't have, you know, that the days of everyone sitting down to dinner at the same time and having weekends together and taking a yearly vacation, those are totally gone for a lot of people. I don't have a statistic if you throw in all those variables, but I'll say 70%, 80% of workers have nothing like that going on anymore. Certainly not in my own situation. And we haven't been on vacation. My family has been on vacation ever, really. So I'm just thinking about that for a second. I'm really mad about that. Anyway, so but this is fairly typical throughout the U.S. workforce now that there seem to be more jobs available. Of course, they're going to be probably low pay, like I mentioned, and et cetera, not good conditions. But when that starts to dry up, which it will, when that comes crashing down, which it will, and the jobs aren't there, and the jobs that are there are still low paid, which is an open question, given if we're in the beginnings of an upsurge of the labor movement, there could be some gains made on wages in significant sectors of the economy, but that's not a guarantee at all. But we'll be talking about that today. If that doesn't happen, then we're going to have the next recession is going to be probably more of a depression in the sense of, buying power will be so low that the corporations will be trying to cut costs and cut prices so rapidly and to keep market share, just to keep things being sold, that you'll have a spiral down into it could happen in other ways too. It could be actually somewhat the opposite, an inflationary spiral, but most likely, at least initially, most likely it will be lack of spending power. And if there's an inflationary spiral, it would be contrary to what you're taught again in school or whatever. Inflation is not caused by wage increase. Inflation is there for other reasons. Like, for example, the price of a commodity that's necessary to allow different production or distribution. If that goes up, then the costs are passed on by the businesses that don't want to take a hit in profits. They want their profit rates to continue. So right now, there's all this talk about the trade wars causing increased inflation, meaning the tariffs that Trump is putting on certain, the Trump administration is putting on certain goods, you'll have the corporations pass that cost along to the people that want to buy things. And for working people, you raise that cost, and all of a sudden we can't buy it. We can't buy it. I mean, we're not gonna. We'll go into debt maybe more, but then debt levels are increasing more right now. So you get to the point where it's just a lot of production is going to be canceled, a lot of unsold goods, and the businesses are aware of that. They start laying off, and it's the same old. Maybe someone that's graduated into this boom period right now doesn't get that. Maybe people have short memories, which they do. Again, lack of a workers' party of some sort in this country with its own media and so on means that the historical memory of most people in America is very low or very twisted. Again, not their fault. It's educational system and so on. It really comes back to capitalism, and this is the most powerful capitalist country in the world, is all about capitalism is all about the short-term maximization of profit. So in the most powerful boardrooms of the world, Goldman Sachs, which the president of Harvard is joining the board or has joined the board of, ex-president of Harvard, Drew Faust, is joining the board or has joined the board of Goldman Sachs. They are all about, how'd the last quarter do? Did our rate of profit go up? Did our aggregate profits go up? It's all about short-term maximization of profit. That's the most important thing for these greedy scum that run this country and the world, basically. And that means that for us, for working people, and I hope you understand there isn't us and them, if you don't get that, time for Socialism 101 again. Read the Communist Manifesto as a start, or read it with a study group if you need to or whatever. For us, if in a boom period we're still struggling and going deeper into debt and seeing basic things that we need like healthcare and education skyrocket in cost, what's it going to be like when the old layoffs start again, when the old crap comes around of the capitalists not being able to sell their stuff because we're the ones that buy most of it? You know, there aren't that many rich people to go around and buy up everything that's produced. It just doesn't work that way. The rich are engaged in conspicuous consumption at a level that's mind-boggling. It's sort of like in math trying to understand what a billion means compared to a million. It's very, very difficult to really grasp that, and we're not taught to grasp that, those differences, because if we knew how much a billionaire, how much money they've amassed, we would understand there's no way they can amass that money through their own efforts. A billionaire is a cog in a corporate machine, but a well-oiled cog, a cog that is given money because it's inherited, that billionaire has inherited the position within a tiny group of less than 1% of the population, much less than 1% actually, that control the means of production, control the big banks, the big corporations, etc., and then hand themselves tons and tons and tons of money in stocks and salaries and stock dividends and salaries and so on. So it's sort of like, you know, if for people to understand the real gap in inequality, the real crisis of the climate, of climate change and so on, and pollution, to understand all these, you know, big questions, how much college tuition has increased. You know, people have a grasping, of course, of that. Some people have it figured out totally, but most people were not taught the math skills or the more importantly, the political skills to analyze political economy, let's say, you know, Marxism, socialism, to analyze the vast, vast gap we're talking about. And that then translates into social class, you know, of course, obviously it has to, or there's no way the lifestyle of a billionaire is going to be the same as the lifestyle of a worker. It's impossible. It's just impossible. And to have the same lifestyle. And that means a lot of different things in terms of where you, what kind of life you live and where you sit and so on. Over here in the U.S., if you're listening from overseas, hey, there's a popular movie out. Maybe it's out in your country as well, Crazy Rich Asians. And I haven't seen this film yet, but it's being touted as a great breakthrough because it's an all-Asian cast and so on. And I can see that. That's a good thing. Still waiting for the Crazy Poor Asian movie, you know, because most Asians on the planet are really poor, as are most people, poor or working class around the world, and we see very little of that in Hollywood. I think class will be the last bastion, the last door sort of broken down in Hollywood, and when that door gets broken down, it'll probably take a revolution to break that one down, because Hollywood is run by rich people, by big corporations, and they don't even understand where to start with a movie about the working class. They try sometimes, and usually really off the mark. And you see how desperate people are for that kind of entertainment too, like Roseanne before it was chased off the air, and I think it should have been. Actually, I agree with that. You know, Roseanne was, well, I don't know. See, I agree. I don't agree with censoring a Roseanne Barr, you know, because who cares what she has to say, really. But I also don't agree with giving Roseanne Barr this platform on what should be the media controlled by the people, you know, the airwaves. This is like public, supposed to be public property, right? and you know, so I could name a lot of people I would like to see off the air. So don't mind seeing her off the air. But I remember that before that scandal hit, based on her racist comments and so on, that I knew she was crazy before that, by the way, because of politics. She got involved in one of the recent elections in the presidential level, started to get involved, and she was just saying crazy stuff one day. And some people fell for it. Even people that I work closely with politically, a few fell for it. People are so desperate for authentic working class voice in politics or in the media that they start to discount what they probably know better of, that it's not just the individual, it's the institutions, obviously, and who controls them and how and so on. But anyway, I remember that when Roseanne, before the scandal hit, that, you know, people whose opinions I respect, people, you know, even some people that are socialists, they would say, oh, that's a very important show, showing aspects of working class life. And, you know, I used to watch it and I didn't recognize it as reflective of my working class background. The only thing I liked about it was, I think, having a lot of people in the room. You know, like if you live in a small house, it's hard to get away from other people, you know? So like, I remember in my family, you'd have somebody scoured away in the corner of the basement, you know, and then somebody up in the attic with the AC on, if it was summertime, back when we finally got AC. And then you'd have maybe me in my room, the door closed, trying to read, you know, and you need that time away from the usual fighting and so on. So there'd be these, but there's times where you have to come together, obviously, to do something, or you were back when we used to eat. People used to eat as a family, including ours, you know. Then you're all thrown together in this too little a space, And so I remember Roseanne watching that show when it first came out and say, oh, yeah, this, you know, I guess in my head or something. I don't even know if I articulated it. Yeah, that kind of looks familiar. They're all kind of bumping into each other in the kitchen and stuff, and they're huddled around the kitchen table a lot. I kind of get that. That looked pretty realistic. So she got some of the superficial stuff right. But the whole thing, the things they said, you know, the constant patter, I don't know. And there was fighting between the characters on the show, but not even enough, I don't think, for you know, for a realistic picture of most families. But there was, I don't know. Just they got some things right, but a lot wrong. The point is that people were so desperate for some sort of representation of working class people on television that they exaggerated both the quality and importance of the show. And of course, with the original Roseanne run, they all win the lottery and become millionaires in the last season. And it completely reflected, just so obviously reflected, the effect of money on this individual, Roseanne Barr, you know, earning more money than, you know, she would ever possibly dream of as in earlier part of her life, as being a successful television producer and actor and so on. And then that being reflected, of course, in the kind of stories that she wanted to see up on the thing. So it's like this proof of Marxism, basically, a proof of, more or less within certain parameters, you can materially scope out, figure out, map out where ideas are coming from based on the material, based on their material support in society, you know, and how someone is living is going to indicate mostly how someone is thinking, not entirely, but that's going to be a trend in their thought. So Roseanne went from having that, you know, at least the memory of the working class existence, however diffused and superficial, to hey, yeah, everyone can win the lottery and and live like this. I didn't see any of the new episodes, thank goodness, but before it got canceled or whatever. And how we got off on that thing on Roseanne, I don't know. Hey, if you were listening last week to the show, Social Alternative, you heard a two-hour interview with a young socialist and member of Social Alternative, Nick Wirsch. Just want to give a shout-out to Nick. That was a great show. Thanks for coming on. Hope you can come back on the show. And we're going to be doing that from time to time. Today, we're expecting Diego back in the co-chair seat. He didn't make it in. But Diego, I hope you get a chance to listen to the show. And again, if you want to listen to Social Alternative Radio, other than when we're on live every other Sunday, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m., just go to WMFO.org, go to Schedules, click on Socialist Alternative Radio. And like I started to say earlier, a new semester is dawning here where we emanate from Tufts University. You see some of the, I think, some freshmen arriving or have arrived. And so we'll have there'll be a new schedule out. Hope we'll get the same time. That can change, but hopefully it won't. But you know, you can always look, go to WMFO.org for information on the new shows. There's an eclectic mix of shows on WMFO, mostly music shows, but some talk and music as well, like this show, some talk shows. And it's a good thing, you know. It's pretty rare programming overall. I mean, this show is extremely rare, to have a socialist radio show, that's not just about alternative information, but about trying to organize people into different struggles and into socialist movement. That's pretty unique, I'd say. But if you go to the music part of WMFO schedule, the fact of the what we call freeform here, and a sort of freeform radio, and a sort of DJs can play whatever they want. Boy, that is a lot different than what you hear outside. I mean, on the rest of the airwaves, with the exception of the college airwaves. But, you know, I have to listen to a lot of radio. I do listen to a lot of radio. I don't have to. I do listen to a lot of radio. Part of it's the commute. Part of it, just I like radio in general. Wow, I mean, like, you know, it's hard to find good music. I mean, this is an old thing. I could have said this 10 years ago, too, but I'm just saying, it's hard to find good music. I mean, the capitalist strangulation over human creativity is nothing new under capitalism, but just really hard to find good music on the radio these days. It was a little bit better, not always, but in the 70s and the 80s. you know, there's statistics to back this up. I don't have them handy, but the monopolization of radio is increased. It's pretty much almost at its peak, you know, in the sense of very few corporations controlling vast amounts of media, television, radio, whatever they call Netflix and all that stuff. Live stream, is that the name for all that stuff? Social media, et cetera. It's all very few owners and fewer and fewer all the time. So around here in Greater Boston, there's like this show. It's probably part of a corporate chain or something, or at least a rich corporation, but claims to be independent. I forget the call number for that. I listen to it a lot. It's up in the Merrimack Valley. 92.5, I think. No, I'm sorry. Yeah, 92.5. But, you know, even they've started to play. I mean, every once in a while, I'll hear like three songs in a row on that station, and I'll be like, oh my God, this is amazing. They play these three songs. I mean, they had Iggy Pop and like somebody else the other day. And I was just like, oh my God, this is amazing. And then they'll follow it up with a commercial, another commercial. Then three rotten songs. And they're starting to play the kind of mainstream pop from the right-hand side of the dial, you know, like from 103 point whatever or 107 point whatever, which I listen to very rarely. And they bring that over, this mainstream overproduced pop, to what's supposed to be an independent radio station. And I'm like, oh God, can't even listen anymore. Anyway, as we promised earlier, we're going to talk about the ubiquitous teams, the ubiquitous UPS workers, the brown trucks, brown uniforms. It was even a TV show, speaking of working class TV, about supposedly about a UPS driver, but again, had really nothing to do with working class life that I could see. Except they had a few shows I saw that in the Teamster, like sort of locker room or something. The workers, the UPS locker room, and that was interesting what they started to do with that a little bit. But anyway, even that was twisted. But anyway, what's happening now with the UPS drivers? This is a 260,000 members of the Teamsters Union working for United Parcel Service, which, by the way, UPS was set up, United Parcel Service, to mimic UPS, United Postal Service. Interesting, right? So, hold on, I'm going to check this technical thing. Why is that playing? Oh my God. I'm having real trouble here with, I don't even know how to turn this off now. Okay, sorry to bother you with the problems here, but I don't see the other earlier problem happening again. Anyway, back to the Teamsters. Wow, a lot of technical problems in this show. I really apologize to the listeners. Anyway, back to reality or whatever. The Teamsters, 260,000, they had this union negotiation that happened, right? And because it's such a big part of the Teamsters Union, 260,000 members, you had top Teamster leaders involved at the highest level negotiating with UPS, maybe even Hoffa, the president of the Teamsters, who should have been gone a long time ago, negotiating or popping into negotiations, I don't really know. Anyway, the point is that it was a big deal. But right early on in negotiations, word leaked out that the negotiators for the Teamsters, probably living a lifestyle way above the members, by the way, were engaged in concessionary bargaining, basically. They were going in ready to take concessions, as most union leaders are now, which is a hugely ridiculous and failed strategy. It's one reason the labor movement is so weak, certainly not the only reason, but if you go in thinking of not making gains, then you're obviously going to make losses, and it's going to obviously get to the point at some point where the material gains of being in the union have been weakened so greatly that workers lose interest in the union as a way to fight back, you know? The union will significantly improve their lives, or, and I don't agree with this, but you'll hear people say, oh, it's not worth the union dues and all that. And let me tell you, it's worth the union dues. Even a bad union is worth the union dues. But you just get these people that just don't, you make those arguments easier to slide off people's lips, however wrong they are, when the union leadership goes in looking for concessions. and it's a very sad thing. And a failed strategy, and that's the most important thing. So, this is going to sound like a long time ago, but 21 years ago, right, there was a big strike of UPS in 1997. I remember the strike vividly. And the workers around the country had, as part of their slogan, part-time America doesn't work. They actually won a big victory with improved benefits for all the workers in UPS and the creation of thousands of new full-time jobs. It was a big victory in 1997. And it came at a time when the left was very weak. There was a beginning of a boom in the economy, although people didn't realize it yet. And, you know, the 90s were tough politically. You had the collapse of Stalinism in the late 80s and into the 90s. And that was supposedly proof that capitalism was a superior system, even though the Stalinists were embracing capitalism, and things have not improved in any big way for the people in those countries. But the point was that Stalinism imploded. The Stalinists became capitalists, a lot of them, and you had all that stuff about the end of history and all that stuff. So the 90s was tough. Capitalism, of course, is the best teacher, as they say. So the experience of living under capitalism has, of course, led the system to be led to the questioning, deep, deep questioning of capitalism or rejection of capitalism by a lot of people since the collapse of Stalinism, by millions and millions around the world, because the system is so unequal, so it generates poverty as a matter of course every minute it exists, creates useless, dangerous wars, threatens the habitability of the planet with global warming and pollution and so on. So it's not like anything stands still, and things are always changing, and under capitalism, mostly changing for the worse. Even developments and in new technologies or whatever, you find out they're implemented in a very unequal way and in a very costly way to the environment and a costly way to a lot of people. And so basically, capitalism, as it reasserted itself, it was also reasserting, the collapse of Stalinism was also reasserting, or the workers' movement was also being reorganized to some extent. And that doesn't seem obvious at first, since there's been a lot of defeats and hits, but the ideas and methods of socialism are making a comeback overall, even in the richest country in the world, here in the U.S. But here you had in 1997 an exceptional event in terms of the way things were going for unions and as I just described, for left politics, where the Teamsters not only went on strike, and you could see the corporate media ready to pounce, you know, when this happened, because I lived through this, and I actually went to the picket lines in solidarity and so on as a member of Socialist Alternative to the UPS drivers in 1997. And there are, by the way, members of Socialist Alternative in UPS, in the Teamsters. And so back in 97, when I saw the corporate media ready to pounce on the strike and talk about, lie, because that's as they always do when they cover strikes, say, oh, the driver's making good money, and blah, blah, blah. And they started to do that stuff, and all of a sudden, it was this moment, this rare moment, there are rare moments like this, where the propaganda was so out of line with the reality that people didn't buy it. And not only did people not buy it, that the corporate media would just desperately search for people to, accept their narrative, accept their sort of slogans and ideas, as usually happens. You know, when they go to interview someone, they can usually get the answer they want, right? It's the way they phrase the questions, it's the way they edit things, it's the way they prepare the ground through a lot of other propaganda about things in general, about capitalism, about people, individuals with no rights, and et cetera. So in 97, they started the usual game plan of distorting what the workers made and calling talking about the necessity of this or that, of taking concessions. And all of a sudden, boom, people would call into the radio shows, or they wouldn't follow the script so much they couldn't even edit down to the things they wanted. And because the people that didn't work for UPS, people that weren't in unions, and you know, this is according to the logic of the corporate media, therefore they're not interested, right, in the struggle. But they started to speak up for these UPS workers, for the guys and women driving around the brown trucks and wearing the brown uniforms. They started speaking up for them and saying, no, I think that, you know, they deserve a better deal, you know? And it was amazing. It was just amazing. And this groundswell happened. And so the corporate media, you know, took a step back, and then they, you know, if they were going to report on the thing at all, they had to report a little bit on that groundswell of support. And there were talk shows, and people would get on the talk shows and say, yeah, you know, there's a lot of support for these workers, you know, and high profile people would come out and support. And it started a steamrolling effect that went the opposite of what the normal trashing of a strike is like. And the workers themselves did a good job of manning their picket lines. There was a lot of support for the strike among the workers. And all of a sudden, UPS was on the defensive. And why was that? Well, in the 90s, there were recessions. I don't know what the popular imagination is about the 90s, or the revisionist history is about the 90s. But the 90s was opened with a recession. In 91, 92, things were not going well. In the mid-90s, by the late 90s, you had the high-tech bubble, as they used to call it, starting up. And like 98, 99 were years of in general, increased wages, and not increased wages overall, but increased wages in certain sectors, and more jobs like now, to the point where you know, the whole high-tech bubble had sucked in a certain percentage of the economy, including a lot of young people. And so it looked like you know, things were rosy, and there was a future in high tech, and it was just starting and so on. But this was the time of like websites with no way of generating any income and so on. And I remember that time really well. And people would get jobs that were jobs where the bosses, the investors themselves, the corporations, the bosses and so on, weren't quite sure what they were up to totally. And they needed that. They needed the computer skills, so they were willing to pay for them. And you know, when that all shook out, there was a lot of money being put into things that couldn't make any money. So the corporations pulled out really rapidly when that became clear, and that triggered in turn a recession. Now that was kind of papered over a bit by 9/11, but by, you know, into the late 2001, 2002, it was clear that there had been a recession that was still lingering on a bit. So if you hit 1997, back when the strike was going on, there was a lot of workers that, although it was entering a boom period, they weren't feeling it. Just a lot like now. By the way, we're going to take a quick, we're going to make a quick mention of the fact that we are WMFO. That's WMFO in Medford, WMFO Medford. 91.5 FM in this area, WMFO Medford, Tufts Free Form Radio, commercial free, community based radio. You're listening to a little slice of that community based socialist alternative radio, talk and music from a working class democratic socialist perspective. And we are here every other Sunday, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. And if you're just tuning in, we are talking about.